All right, I want to thank the committee, whoever wrote letters of support for me, and all of you for being here, and all of you in the back who are not going to leave, okay? I'll say, this is one of the most stressful presentations that I could have even thought about doing, and I had a lot of problems trying to put it together, and I wanted it to be perfect, and I'm telling you, it is not perfect. But that's okay. So, in trying to prepare this today, I found Ned Hook, and I said, Ned, what am I going to talk about? And he said, you can talk about whatever you want. And I thought, well, that could be dangerous. And then I asked John Zentelman, where are you? And he said, I don't know, but I'll think about it and let you know. And I thought, well, that's definitely dangerous. And then I talked to Khalil Ghanem, and he said, I know exactly what you're going to do. He said, you're going to tell a story, you're going to give clear take-home messages, and for God's sake, keep it short. So these are my objectives today. And I'm going to try to weave this story into the theme of this, is transcending barriers, right? And the first question, and Jonathan alluded to it, when I was the chair of the Women's Task Force, I knew what was going on with the women and the young men faculty, but I wanted to know what, you know, how do you succeed in academics from the people that are above? So I went to the department chairs, and I asked, how do you succeed in academics? And this one answer stuck with me. Find a pack that you can love and run with them. And this was said by Fred Brancati, who is the Chief of General Internal Medicine. Many of you know him and love him. So, let's start. Hell yeah, you're all coming down with me. Once upon a time, I met a boy. And although I, prior to meeting this boy, this was in the winter of 1981, and prior to meeting this, I was trying to formulate, what the heck am I going to do? And I thought, well, you know, I had very loose plans. I thought, well, maybe I'll apply to the EIS program. They wouldn't have accepted me, but maybe I would apply to the EIS program to investigate this strange disease that was infecting Haitians in Miami. And that's where I was doing my internal medicine training, so I thought, yeah. But, of course, I met this boy, and things changed, and we planned to get married, and he wanted to go to do his internal medicine training in Seattle. And I was thinking, Seattle? That's on the other part of the world from Miami. But they must have infectious diseases there, so, you know, okay. And for some reason, they gave me an interview. Maybe because Charlie was still there. So I got on a plane. Okay, here's a little plane. Here I go. And I, on that plane ride, I read every article I could get my hands on STDs. Not that we didn't have STDs in Miami, but these people were actually studying STDs. And, you know, it was then when I got off that plane that I met a group of people that changed my life. I met my pack. These are the leaders of the pack. And, you know, they're not the four horsemen of the apocalypse, no. These guys, they rock. And I didn't know it then, but I thought, you know, there's something special here. And luckily, these four gentlemen, of course, led by King, who, you know, had a spidey sense out, they saw something special in me. Because really, I didn't come from an Ivy League college or a prestigious medical school at the time. Now it is for you. And, you know, it was an okay training program. So even though they accepted me, and of course it was outside the match, I was happy. And they assigned me to a project that I don't think anybody inside the match would have taken. And that was the proctitis proctocolitis treatment study, following in the footsteps of the infamous Thomas Quinn, who is shown here, as he would like to be remembered. And Tom, you know, Daniel Craig, step down. There's still time for you. Okay. I actually got an ASHA fellowship. and following in the footsteps of Sheila Lucard, thank you very much, part of my pack, and I felt incredibly happy to be given a chance to transcend into this world of infectious disease. And I didn't know it then, but I was given a gift. I was handed a protocol, given a room in the STD clinic, and introduced to my study assistant, who's shown here, Charlie Price, who became my rock. I was assigned to my boss, who's shown here, who became my mentor and my favorite superhero, Walt Stamm. But it was Susan Cates who introduced me to the joys of teaching through STD HIV prevention training centers. And through all the future academic ups and downs, this act of trying to translate research into practice and prevention and share it with my colleagues and students and patients became my driving force. And along running with this pack, there are times when you're absolutely exhausted. This gave me my second wind. So I started to run with the pack, and I was given a kind of freedom that involved attention and awareness and discipline and effort and being able to truly care about other people. It was in the STD clinic that I met my most important teachers. And they were the clinicians, the front desk staff, the lab staff, and of course the DIS. And I'm going to say here right now, anybody who is in this field of prevention, diagnosis, treatment, needs to ride with the DIS, because you're going to learn. Yes, you can cry. So not only did I learn how to diagnose and treat STDs, but I learned to meet patients where they were, ask incredibly personal questions with no judgment, listen to what was being said, hear what was not being said, and maybe even give a voice to the population traditionally cloaked in shame and stigma and secrecy. And I, of course, learned to embrace the eccentric and the humor in tragedy. And tragedy was coming. In 1982, this is when I got there, gay men were celebrating their liberation from a previously locked closet. And it was, bath houses were booming, sisters of perpetual indulgence were skating the streets of San Francisco, and STDs were at the party. Look at them. Right here. Where's that? Well, you can see 1982. Look, everything's up there. Everything's hot and high. But bad news was coming. And you know, we didn't even have an idea of the magnitude of the devastation it would bring. This was like the first case in Seattle in November. And then you can see Hunter and Ann Collier, my colleagues, go into the Seattle Gay Clinic to discuss this. And this was in December, right after that, not a month later. But back in the clinic, I learned to view the rectum as a venereologist. Okay? This is a paper that was handed to me by Walt Stamm when I was doing my proctitis proctocolitis lecture. And this was written by R.R. Wilcox at the Department of Venereology in St. Mary's Hospital in London, 1981. Let me quote what he says. The complexity and variety of the sexual act is shown in this figure. The anus and rectum of homosexual women are at little risk of venereal infection, but in some heterosexual women and nearly all homosexual men, being the recipients of the male organ, that infamous deadly male organ, what? The risks are much greater. The bottom line is this. Look at the figure. I mean, an STD jumps everywhere. Doesn't matter if you're a male or a female, you're gay, straight, transsexual. Hey, look. Look. Okay. So, this is what Walt gave me, and this is what I've introduced to. And I was trained to ask these questions. All sorts of questions, like Dennis asked. And some of my patients with proctitis, proctocolitis. I don't even know you can see this, but this is the original proctitis, proctocolitis questionnaire of this study. And we ask age and sex and ethnicity and all that stuff, and number of partners in the past month, and all of this. And we also asked about sexual practices. This is 1982, passive anal intercourse, oral anal active, oral anal passive, genital contact. I mean, this goes on and on, foreign objects, and they threw in their, what, drink, stream, or well water, just in case. Okay. And this person came in with proctitis and proctocolitis, and I wasn't that great at asking questions, and I got no on everything. But as time went on, I got better, and I started to get more comfortable asking the questions, and they became more comfortable telling me what was going on. And this drove home very sage advice given by Hunter Hansfield, which I think holds true today. Don't ask, won't tell. Don't look, won't find. Now, we're supposed to be doing EPT, right? Or not EPT, yeah. Extragenital testing, EGT. You know? Okay, that's all. So, this was an exciting time of discovery. This is what was going on. We looked at all sorts of things. We looked at the empirical therapy for the management of acute proctitis in gay men, and we found it worked. And we looked at this new drug, which was acyclovir for herpes proctitis, and it worked. And we even found new organisms with the crew. We found new organisms that were causing it, Campylobacter species. And this rapid diagnostic test, we studied them in that time. It was direct immunofluorescence. We're way far beyond that. But, hey, this was exciting. And I even did anal pap smears back in 1983. And we reported on that. We also started to look at the association between genital ulcer disease and acquisition of HIV infection in gay men. And this was a lot of information, and we felt like we were moving the field forward and at least learning things and doing better by our patients. So by 1986, my training was over, and it was time to pursue a real job. So in an attempt to delay this, of course, Charlie and I decided to take a year postgraduate training. Of course, that's what you do. And we went to London, and this is where the pack expanded. And I worked at the James Pringle House Genitourinary Medicine Clinic and met Dr. Professor Adler, Mike Adler, and Ian Weller and Adrian Mundell. And we were in the clinic while Princess Diana, of course, was breaking down the fear barrier of AIDS by shaking hands with someone. Now, this was huge at the Middlesex Hospital right across the street. This was huge. She did not become part of my pack, I may say, but hey, tried. But Charlie and I increased our pack, and we had Elizabeth, our queen, and we started to continue our journey. And we went from London to Baltimore, Charlie to pursue pulmonary critical care medicine, and me to go to the School of Public Health to get my master's in epidemiology, yay. And to work in the STD clinics. And the HIV epidemic kept evolving. This is in February of 87. The activist Cleve Jones creates the first panel of the AIDS Memorial Quilt. And then in March, Larry Kramer founds ACT UP. And not 9 months later, in October, AIDS Memorial Quilt goes on display in D.C. And here, from one panel, this is what it looks like. 9 months. So, you know, I was calling Seattle, and I was asking Charlie Price to find out how my guys were doing on the proctitis, proctocolitis study. And I'd say, how's John? How's Derek? How's Bob? And he'd tell me, well, John's not doing so good. He has cryptococcal meningitis, and Derek is disseminated tuberculosis, and Bob's in the ICU with PCP. And he said, you know, Ann, you got to stop asking. And I said, okay. And it was at that moment where I knew I can't take care of AIDS patients. This is breaking my heart. I can't do it. Remember, we didn't have all the sexy stuff we had today. Now, this is where we were. And the diagnosis and death were like following parallel lines. So the take-home message, Khalil, young folks, find your pack. Find a pack that you can love. People who will listen to you, support you, criticize you, be there for you. And listen. Be patient. I know they're old. Hey, we're all... But listen, you have a lot to offer. So do they. Oh, folks, take a chance. Every once in a while, somebody's going to come in front of you, and they won't have the pedigree that you want. But hey, if something your spidey sense says, hey, there's something there, take a chance. Sometimes it works for everyone. And be tolerant and listen to your young folks. Okay, we try to watch where we're going. We try to listen at all times. Listen to your patients. They're telling you where you should go. And every once in a while, slow down and appreciate where you are. How am I doing? We're doing okay. Okay, let's move to part two. Transcending barriers, recognizing opportunity. Everybody has a story. This is from Charlene Wiley, who works in our clinic. You know, interesting things are happening right here when I got to Baltimore. People, especially MSM, they were scared. Behavior was changing. This abstinence, be faithful, use condoms, start to make sense. Gonorrhea rates were coming down, but they continued to go down. And primary and secondary syphilis rates were going to plummet soon after. So, you know, when I arrived at Johns Hopkins, which is shown here, and all of you that you know this picture if you've been there, there was no more proctitis, proctocolitis for me to study among MSM. And it was like, yay! And then it was like, I'm an expert in something that no longer exists. Yay? What am I going to do? So, you know, all of you who have been to Hopkins, you realize that under this dome here, there's a statue of Jesus, okay? And I want you to know that Jesus looks directly at the STD clinic, two blocks down. So I'm saying, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And I'm walking by Jesus, and it's like Jesus said to me, get a grip. Walk down to that STD clinic, go see some patients, and they'll let you know what to do. So I walk down. Here it is, right there, two blocks down. And I know, it got, don't ignore that, ignore that, okay? This is Baltimore, but ignore that. And I was thinking, you know, what do I like to do? Well, I like to diagnose and treat STDs. I love to see that spirochete swimming around. I know I can kill it. I like to kill it. I'd like to diagnose it faster. I'd like to diagnose it more efficiently. And though I don't want to treat AIDS patients, I sure do want to prevent HIV. So I start listening to the stories. And the story centered in poverty and sexual abuse and exploitation and discrimination. Some stories were resulting or resulted from depression and despair with consequent alcohol and drug use. And let me tell you, many people didn't use drugs, but honestly, the drug economies as shown here in this time frame with drug abuse-related deaths, mentioning crack cocaine, and this is in Baltimore, it was there, and it was booming. And you know, genital ulcers, this is the case of the primary and secondary syphilis, was following quickly. A lot of genital ulcers. Now, you have to realize that along with Jesus is then the dome, all right, of Hopkins, Osler's ghost roams the hall. This is Baltimore. We made the news every which way. But here he is, and he said, of course, everybody knows this, knows syphilis and its manifestations and relations and all of the things clinical will be added onto you. You'll know medicine. And, of course, Osler spoke directly to me, and he said, I know syphilis, and you don't. So, in the process, I thought, you know what? I'm going to look at these genital ulcers. I'm going to look at syphilis. And in the process of doing this, I found my true and lifelong pack. Now, here they are. Look at them. They look so... Look at them. They look so... Yeah. No. It's not like that. Okay? This is what they really look like. Oh! Here you go. Oh, and there's more. They're out there. Look, this is the pack. You look for yourselves in here. You're in here. Oh, look at that John Allen. And, you know, over time, some of them, my pack, they peeled off. Some to go to academics at a different institution, Alabama, and some to go to the NIH. Others to go to administration. Administration, for God's sake, in Florida? But there you go. And some retired. And others, Terry Hogan, tried to retire, but we won't let her go. So this pack helped me. Ah, yes. They helped me run. We ran. We howled when we didn't have funding, NIH funding, which you know what that's like. And they helped me celebrate the birth, an extension of our family, our Miss Maggie and Zachary, who are shown here. And we galloped along, and we discovered many things. And I'm going to show you some of them. Characteristics of patients with syphilis that came into the clinic. We described that. And the association of biologic false positives. God knows we still have a lot of that. Asymptomatic neurosyphilis after doxy. Altered clinical presentation of early syphilis and HIV. We even played with the CDC when they were doing the infamous enhanced therapy trial for early syphilis, and that was fun with Bob Rolfs and associates. We defined genital ulcers and variations of them in the risk for prevalent HIV infection, and we even went to Pune. We took this information, went to Pune, India, and I will say this. We finally got NIH funding to study the disease. And if any of you want to know how to eliminate a disease, get NIH funding to study it. Do you hear me? As soon as we got NIH to study this, the disease went away. Okay. But you know what? There were others. There were other diseases that were out there. It wasn't just syphilis. Look, I mean, you know, gonorrhea and chlamydia in Baltimore at the time were happily doing just fine. And, of course, there was always HIV. But in 1995, a really cool thing happened. The highly active antiviral therapy became available. And all of a sudden, people with HIV were living. They were living. And this is incredibly exciting. Less deaths were happening. So preventing the disease in the first place was getting more of the spotlight. And although the rates were decreasing in MSM, this is in Baltimore now, and you can see that, and they started to decrease in injection drug users, harm reduction, and I hopefully, God, please, that they'll stay going down and stay that way, they started to creep up in heterosexuals, especially African-American women at this time. So I extended my pack by joining an amazing group of investigators, and this was the HIV epidemiology research study. And I learned that collaboration with the right group of people outside your institution could be incredibly exciting. And actually, these conference calls were fun. I know that's an oxymoron, but these conference calls were fun. And even though I had studied epidemiology, this group taught me how to actually apply it. So we followed almost 900 HIV-infected women and almost 500 uninfected at-risk women over about 7 years. And they were from New York and Detroit and Providence and Baltimore. And we learned so much. We looked at the influence of injection drug use behavior on using HART. Longitudinal study of mucosal candida species in HIV positive and negative. Possible effects of continuing using drugs on the progression of HIV. Khalil joined the group. You start running. influence of sex hormones, HIV status, and concomitant STIs on cervical vaginal inflammation, and heart therapy, the effect on HPV clearance and cervical cytology. So the take-home message of this part is that, hey, barriers are going to arise. You know, you may lose your expertise because it's gone. That's okay. Look around. Opportunity is there. It's there. Be open to it and act on it. Now, this is an introducing opportunity to others. Quote Osler, "No bubble is so iridescent or floats longer than that blown by a successful teacher." Throughout this whole journey, I was fortunate to be part of the STD HIV prevention training centers. And I started in Seattle, and this is 1981, and then ended up in Baltimore. And, you know, the regional sites have shifted, and they've expanded, and they've involved the clinical, and they've involved behavioral, and they've involved partner services. And you're interacting with everyone that's in this room with this. And I want to say that the passion and devotion to teaching, treating, and preventing STDs has stayed constant no matter where we were and how it's changed. And there's not a better, more devoted group of people to work, teach, and play with than these friends. And I want to thank every one of you for what you do in spreading our prevention messages and how well and enthusiastically you continue to do it. So thank you, all my PTC friends. But you know what? This is me. Our work is not done. Look, here we are again. You all have been at this conference. You know where we are. The trends in adult and adolescent reported HIV diagnosis. I'm done with this. You know you're in trouble because I'm not reading off my paper. The rates are going up in MSM. I mean, look, you know the snapshot. You've heard this, you know? This is taken right out from the CDC page where increased chlamydia from what? Up from 13 to 14, 3%. Gonorrhea, 5%. Syphilis, 15%. Congenital syphilis, almost 30%. Gay bisexual men face the highest and rising number of syphilis infections. I'm preaching to the choir, but, you know, our work is not done. And look, you know this, prevalence of resistance is there. But there is good news. I mean, really, the PrEP is, look at all these options. This is, to me, like reproductive health clinics used to be with the, you know, choices of contraception. We have oral PrEP, and it works. And you've seen all the slides there. And novel adherence strategies. And we have vaginal and rectal microbicides and intravaginal rings, hopefully, that will be a little bit better. But they're working. And then we have injectables. We're going to do the injectable PrEP studies and monoclonal antibody studies, cabotegravir and the VRC01. These are very important, exciting trials to prevent HIV. And that's good. But remember, here we are. Y'all know we're right back here. And it's not that. It's sexually active people are getting infections, whether you're gay, straight, bisexual, LGBT, trans, whatever. It happens, so we have to be aware. And we talked about this morning. It's a combination of HIV prevention and STD prevention and pregnancy prevention. It doesn't fit all. One size doesn't fit all, but we need to do all of this, whoever walks in. So the take-home messages. If you go into the field of STDs and HIV, your job is secure. Sex happens. For the love of God, let us run together toward sexual health for all. You know what? And as we're running here in this pack, we need to grab some young people and make them run with us. Go out. Recruit. We need young blood. And that's, you know, important, because great ideas are coming from young people. and fight to maintain safe spaces for the diagnosis, treatment, and prevention of STDs. I know there's a lot of ACA stuff going on, I know, but we still need safe spaces like STD clinic. Call it whatever, call it reproductive health, call it sexual health, but have a clinic, a safe space where people can actually come and you and the clinicians, providers, counselors will be comfortable asking them the questions and doing the right things. The Dean Street Clinic, I love it. We should all have that. But let's try to go toward keeping these safe spaces. Okay, this is part four, achieving balance. When you're on your deathbed, you're not going to say, I wish I had spent more time at work. Jonathan Zinnelman. Ha, 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 you forgot you said that. I'm going straight to take-home messages here. Don't feel guilty about spending time with your family. You're allowed. It's a good thing. If you're going to have children, pick a partner who will help you raise them, and for love of God, find a support system to help keep them and you sane. And this is Yvonne Fosner, who took care of my children with me, took care of my mother when she moved in with us, and is now taking care of Charlie and I. And of course, exercise, wear sunscreen, and floss. And then finally, we'll close with Osler. The most essential thing for happiness is the gift of friendship. And I like to thank my lifelong friends, Jonathan and Carol Zinnelman, Tom Quinn, Charlotte Gatos, Joel Gatos, Jeannie, Cole Leo, and of course, Mary Teresa Hogan, who is my sometimes therapist, oftentimes confidant, and always friend. And I thank you all for being with me through all the births and all the happiness and all the health and all the sickness. Thank you so much. I'd like to thank my in-laws who put up with all of us through this. Helene, Lee, and Marvin Wiener, and of course my family, ha ha ha, of course you're going to be in here, who have continued to love me, and I love them. So, this is how Zachary describes our pack, my son. Loving the life of the clinic or hospital hallways, feeling called to care, giving someone dignity by not balking at their illness, learning to find a dynamic serenity in the constant wave of others' tough circumstances. This is our pack. I am proud to be running with you all. And may we all live happily ever after, spreading no evil. The end.
I think that a healthy society stays healthy by doing what we've done today, by recognizing those that work with us to accomplish the things that I spoke about yesterday, our mission, our vision, and our passion. You've heard all of that today. This is who we are as a society. This is the work that we do. This is the dedication that we make. We have another year to work. Let's get going. Thank you all.